Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Charlotte Gunnar-Wardener in this episode. Lani is Distinguished Professor of Distance Education and Instructional Technology with the University of New Mexico, and her work in learning design and distance education draws on more than 25 years of scholarship. This podcast is sponsored by the International Council for Open and Distance Education, ICDE, the leading global membership organization working towards bringing inclusive, quality education to all. By joining the ICDE global network of flexible and distance learning, you can help transform the world through inclusive education. Become a member or find out more by visiting www.icde.org. I'm talking with Professor Charlotte Gunnar-Wardener, Distinguished Professor of Distance Education and Instructional Technology in the Organization, Information and Learning Sciences Program in the College of University Libraries and Learning Sciences at the University of New Mexico. Charlotte has published and presented on distance education for over 25 years and has over 100 publications to her credit. And her work will no doubt be familiar to many listeners. Charlotte, it's great to be talking with you.
Wonderful to be talking with you too, Mark.
Thank you. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
So when I reflect on my career in distance education, I think my biggest motivator has been providing access to education. And I look at access from a multidimensional point of view, not only the physical access to technology, but also the psychological access, the comfort level, and how we bridge the different types of distance learning environments, such as social and cultural distances in learning environments. Mm-hmm. So when I left my home country, Sri Lanka, in 1980 to pursue further education in the US, I was one of the lucky ones who had a chance at a university education in Sri Lanka. Because at that time, approximately 85% of students who passed the A-level exam, which is the university entrance exam, could not enter the traditional universities funded by the government. So many of my peers and friends who did extremely well in their advanced level exam could not get into a traditional university. There were very few opportunities to pursue higher education outside the traditional university system. So I always wondered if there was an alternative way to provide higher education to those who could not access traditional face-to-face education in these universities. And this really was the motivator for my career. So I completed a bachelor's degree in English in Sri Lanka and taught English for 3 years at a school in Colombo, the capital city, and then moved to the sub-department of English at the University of Colombo as a researcher. I did a research study on the use of English in job situations in organizations in Colombo, which really began my interest in conducting research and furthering my education. And I was fortunate to receive a scholarship from the American Association of University Women and the University of Kansas to study teaching of English as a second language for my master's degree.
Great.
So while working on my master's, I became really interested in how media could provide access to education and how people learn from media. At that time, it was predominantly instructional television and video. So this interest in media led me to study for a PhD in curriculum and instruction with an emphasis in instructional technology and a minor in instructional television at the University of Kansas.
Yeah.
So my dissertation on new communications technologies and distance education provided the foundation for my career in distance and online education. So after a brief postdoc appointment at the University of Oklahoma, and I did a lot of distance education research with my colleagues there. I took up a position as assistant professor at the University of New Mexico. And this was a dream job for me as it provided the opportunity to develop my career in distance education. They wanted me to develop the distance education program in the department. So this is a graduate level program. I retired last year from the University of New Mexico after serving for 33 years as a professor in distance education and instructional technology. I enjoyed the ride. I enjoyed developing the graduate emphasis in distance education in my academic program, which is now called Organization, Information, and Learning Sciences, and concluded my career teaching graduate-level courses in culture and global e-learning, e-learning course design, research in online education, cross-cultural issues in adult learning, and advanced evaluation. So you can see I have combined several areas in my career. Yeah. And these were the courses that I was teaching when I retired. What I really enjoyed most was working with my students on collaborative networking projects. So one of my early projects was called GlobalAid, which connected graduate students in several universities to explore research in distance education. And similar projects with students in Morocco and China, connecting my students at UNM, at the University of New Mexico, with international students. So as an Asian Development Bank consultant, I trained online tutors and mentors in Sri Lanka. And as a World Bank consultant, more recently, I helped the Ministry of Health in Sri Lanka to develop online courses for professional development of primary care physicians. So these and other international projects have provided impetus for my research and publications. So now a little bit about my research and publications. Because of my passion in providing access to education, my publications have centered on the social environment of online learning, as it is the social environment that engages and sustains our students online. Two of my co-authored publications in 1997 have made an impact on online learning research. One was on the role of social presence in online learning. And the other was focused on the development of the interaction analysis model to analyze social construction of knowledge online. These two lines of research then prompted me to look at the sociocultural context of online learning and how culture influences the learning process. A co-edited book I wrote on culture and online learning examined the role of culture and the sociocultural context, while another co-authored book on culturally inclusive instructional design developed a framework called Wisdom Communities, or WISCOM, to help instructional designers design culturally inclusive learning environments for inquiry-based learning. I really feel that a conducive learning environment where diverse students can feel connected can produce amazing learning experiences. So right now, my co-authors and I are currently working on a book on how to research social construction of knowledge online with social learning analytic methods and AI. We reconceptualized the old interaction analysis model created in 1997 and are developing an AI large language model to analyze social construction of knowledge based on the IAM. We published a paper on our initial research. We're still trying to run this large language model on several data sets. But one of our initial papers titled Deep Learning Models for Analyzing Social Construction of Knowledge Online was published in the Online Learning Journal last year. We are trying to automate the process of analyzing online discussions because it takes such a long time to analyze them qualitatively. So we can get a quick snapshot of the level of knowledge construction reached by discussion participants. So what we are trying to do is to combine qualitative methods of analysis with more quantitative ones, such as social network analysis and social learning analytics. So when I talk about analytics, it's not the learning analytics institutions use to predict enrollment or student achievement, but social learning analytic methods on how group dynamics support the online learning process. So that's the type of analytics we are interested in. So our work has evolved from more qualitative analysis of online interactions to incorporating more quantitative methods, such as social network analysis and social learning analytics.
Coming back to the very start of your career, Charlotte, you mentioned how difficult it was to actually get into university. And many of your colleagues or friends who had achieved sufficient academic expertise to enter university were unable to do so. Why was that? Were universities, did they have limited places? What was the barrier there?
Limited places. Because, you know, in Sri Lanka, I think at that time, so I entered university way back, I think in 72, there were, I think, 6 traditional universities, and they were supported by the government. So you didn't really have to pay much. It was a small administrative fee. And the problem was the lack of spaces. And so there were more students graduating and being successful and fewer places. So now the scenario has changed. There are more traditional universities, and also there are more private universities, and many universities in Sri Lanka also have international connections. So there are collaborative degrees. So there's a lot of opportunity now because of distance learning.
Good, good. I just want to pick on something else too that you mentioned, 33 years in distance and online education. A lot will have changed over that time. So you're into socio-constructivism. You talked about the social elements of learning with reference to the model from Athabasca. What changes have you noticed in how technology is influencing education across that time? Because 33 years ago, I think we would have been using asynchronous discussion boards. How have things shifted now in the intervening time?
Yeah, still for, you know, in higher education, if you look at, you have to look at the different realms, like higher education versus informal learning versus professional development, you know, still in higher education, the learning management systems have a hold. So from instructional television, we shifted over to the computers and computer-mediated communication. Actually, yeah. At the University of New Mexico, I want to share this with you, which you might find interesting. They still have correspondence courses and instructional television courses. Because we are a largely geographically distributed state. You know, we are a mountainous state, difficult to reach students. And actually, instructional television, students in Native American reservations actually prefer instructional television simply because they don't have very good online Wi-Fi connections at home.
Yeah.
So they come to a close by campus to participate in an instructional television program. So they still do that, even though online learning has taken over. So what I have seen is the shift in technologies, you know, from correspondence to television and now to computers. And then, of course, with AI and chatbots, it's a whole different ballgame now. But at the same time, these old technologies still have their place. And still the problems are very similar to what it was in a specific technology. So when we talk about social presence, for example, social presence in asynchronous versus synchronous, like what we are doing right now, versus chatbots, and how real are these pedagogical agents that you have to talk with today, we still are dealing with some of those same issues of presence, for example.
So the community of inquiry model still applies?
Well, I haven't done research with the community of inquiry model because I have worked with mostly what we have developed as the interaction analysis model, which talks about 5 phases in the construction of knowledge, from sharing and comparing to cognitive dissonance to construction of new meaning, and then testing and applying the newly constructed meaning. So that's the model I was talking about. Then for instructional design, we developed another model called Wisdom Communities to design online learning experiences. So the COI, what Terry Anderson and Randy Garrison and others have developed, is one of the most researched and one of the most well-known frameworks for distance learning research. But I haven't really conducted research with the COI.
Okay, so the social presence that you were researching then, did that come from the COI?
Now, what is interesting about social presence is how we define it. And we all define it a little bit differently. My definitions very early is very similar to what Short, Williams, and Christie said about presence in terms of the salience of the other person. You know, that's how they defined it. The original definition from Short, Williams, and Christie in 1976 was the salience of the other person in a mediated communication sequence. So when I defined it in my 1995 and 1997 paper, I just used simple English and just said the realness of the other, the feeling of realness. But subsequently, now I think Garrison and Anderson in the COI model define it as the projection of your presence into a learning community. So I just feel that that is a little step above. Then others have talked about belongingness and other ways of defining it. But one problem might be that we might be thinking about community when we actually define presence. So I'd like to keep those definitions and constructs apart, because it's easier to do research when you can really define your terms and define your constructs, right? But definitely, social presence is still going to be a major area of research.
Great. I want to pick up on wisdom communities as well, because the cross-cultural communication and learning element is quite important. How did you come across that, and where is the theory at the moment?
So we published the book, and we've helped design learning environments using that. Personally, for me, I have designed my online courses at UNM using the wisdom communities model. And I have found that students do connect and build community when you use the strategies that we think are important for people to connect and build communities. Like when my Native American students, who often feel disenfranchised in classrooms, come and tell me, you know, we really felt part of this class.
Yeah,
I just feel I have achieved my goal, because that is what I'm working towards. So wisdom communities is an interesting, how it began is as a student project. You know, I was teaching an advanced course on instructional design, and I had given this assignment to my students to develop a new framework for online learning to help designers, because the ADDIE model doesn't quite fit every situation, right?
Yeah.
So what they came up after class was called final outcome centered on the learner, but it had the main elements that WISCOM currently has. And two of my students who got their PhDs and are now faculty themselves said, let's write more about this. And then we developed this concept of wisdom as a quality to work towards rather than intelligence, because wisdom has many characteristics that are way above being smart or intelligent. It incorporates creativity, but it also incorporates things like humility, which we want students to develop. Collaboration, you know, helping one another. So it has a lot of values that we want to really support students to hopefully accept and live by.
Excellent. Yeah. And how does that work in the online space? Because again, just coming back to the changes in technology, we've gone from where we would have had to have typed things to now where we can actually Zoom things. How has that influenced the theory and how it's actualized?
How we actualize it is the central part of WISCOM is a wisdom community. So the ultimate goal is to develop community, right? And then you have to think about technology. What technologies are you using? Synchronous, asynchronous, combination. You know, it could be artificially mediated technologies, etc. But through all of those technologies, what's important is the communication process itself. How do people communicate through those technologies? Now, we've got to understand, if we really focus on the sociocultural context, not everybody wants to communicate. There are the lurkers. There are those who will lead discussions. There are those who make it difficult for others to come in. So the whole social environment of a connected learning experience over time has to be considered. But the key elements of supporting learning is what we call distributed co-mentoring. And mentoring is not just the teacher and the students, but also students with each other. So that, and it is distributed because you can bring community members as mentors. And I did a project with Sri Lanka, with faculty in Sri Lanka, when I was training them as online tutors and mentors. I connected my graduate students here at UNM with them, and they co-mentored. My students learned about the cultural context and how to do education. The faculty in Sri Lanka learned about how to design and facilitate inquiry-based learning. The other one is learner support. You know, as you know, learner support is so critical for any type of learning. So what types of learning? And then we take them through an inquiry cycle, which we hope will lead to transformative learning. So you start with a learning challenge. Then you get this group to initially explore and figure out what they know and what they don't know. So the challenge can be a question, it can be a problem, it can be a case. Once they have determined what they know about the problem and share that, they go and look at resources. And they reflect on them together as a group, and then they negotiate and come up with you know, certain understandings which they preserve. And the cycle starts again. I think if we get students to inquire rather than provide information, but get them actively inquiring, I think we can actually enhance critical thinking in many of our students.
Yeah, I fully endorse your view there. We've talked a bit about the ideas and themes your work has provided. Your observations about online learning and education at the present time, we're approaching mid-2024. What are some of the observations you have about how online learning is operating at the moment?
So now what is interesting is the whole release of ChatGPT and AI algorithms, I think, have stirred up much controversy about their role in higher education, especially online education. And what I'm also seeing about it is that some of the old distance education issues, such as students cheating online, now have taken a new turn. Before I retired, I was on an online learning faculty committee, sort of like a board of faculty and administrators, where we look at online learning for the university. And some of our participants who are engineering professors were really concerned that ChatGPT could take their exams. And so my question there was, you know, what type of exams are you designing that ChatGPT can be successful at? Most probably you're designing exams that don't really get them to think critically or that help them create new things. And so I think as faculty, what we have to do is to rethink how we assess our students. So that's our main thing. You know, with these new technologies, it's not that the technology can do the job for us, but how can we do it so that the human potential comes out? And another thing that I'm observing is, you know, we are globally connected, and in many of our learning environments are diverse, especially in New Mexico, we are a very diverse state. And so interest in culturally inclusive instructional design will continue to grow. How do we make learners feel that they are part of a learning experience when they are not physically there and connected? So when I was doing the projects for primary care physicians in Sri Lanka, one of the things I noticed was that these are physicians who work in very remote hospitals in the country without much resources, no professional development. And what they were saying was that they also would like to have these Zoom calls or real-time calls with expert physicians who can talk about the diseases and with whom they can ask questions and get answers. And I think that that interactive sequence, you know, the real-time interactive sequence with an instructor is important. And although some online programs say we cannot have synchronous discussions, I think it's really important. In fact, our online digital learning center said the same thing. You know, you have only a certain percent of synchronous discussions, but I held my discussions every week. And I think it helped a lot of students because they ask questions, we develop community, they present what they learn to others, so they are teaching others. So I think the synchronous aspect is very important for asynchronous learning.
Great. Well, Charlotte, the research you'd most like to see, clearly there's a lot of themes at the moment that are of interest to you. If you opened up a journal and found the perfect article on a subject that really interested you, what would that article be about?
So one of the questions that I have is, how can AI be used creatively in learning environments, and how do they impact learning? So how can AI and chatbots provide access to learning, and in which cultural context? So this February, when I was in Sri Lanka, I went to a very remote village, and this was a village that was really under siege during the civil war, and many people were disenfranchised. And I did a workshop for English teachers, and I had them create a poem in groups, and they had to select a topic in their own community. Like one chose the topic of a lake, another forest, for example. And they created a poem about it. You know, I told them to look at images. I showed them how to look at the images and create this poem. So they created it through their own human creativity in a group. And then I said, well, let's look at ChatGPT. I introduced them to ChatGPT. And I said, now look at how it can create that poem for you. Put some words that you have in your original poem into the ChatGPT command line. And they were quite amazed. And what they found was that they got information that they hadn't known about that specific subject that they wrote about. So what I really felt there was that ChatGPT could provide greater access to learning for people who don't have access. And especially in this community, everybody but one teacher had a smartphone, and the smartphone could do really amazingly as an educational tool in remote locations like that. So I think there is real value in these AI chatbots, but we have to really look at media literacy programs to help them understand, you know, the pros and cons, and how AI can also hallucinate and give you the wrong information.
Great. It sounds like we're entering a very interesting age of distance education opportunity through AI and large language models.
Yeah, I think we are. But I think another main area that I think we need to do research on is the ethical use of findings from machine learning and deep learning algorithms, as they may not be 100% accurate nor provide a reasonable picture when devoid of context and learner characteristics. So this is something we have to watch out for as and especially as administrators, not to base all your judgments about students, faculty, etc., on these automated algorithms, which can be really dangerous, because unless you know the socio-cultural context, unless you know the learner characteristics, unless you know the past history of these learners, you may be making huge mistakes.
Well, to conclude, two people you'd recommend as leaders or legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
So the person I would really love to recommend that you connect with is Professor Marina McIsaac. She's Emerita Professor of Educational Technology at Arizona State University. I have learned a great deal from her international research in Turkey and Portugal. To frame my own questions on culture and socio-cultural context of online learning, we have also collaborated several years ago on book chapters for the Handbook of Research on Educational Communications and Technology that was edited by David Jonathan. And her research on social presence and the social environment of online learning has also been a great influence. The other thing that you might want to look at is Susan Bainbridge and Noreen Walk. They wrote the Encyclopedia of Female Pioneers in Online Learning.
Oh, yes, yes.
Published by Routledge, and I think you might find a few people there.
Excellent.
I have also worked with Gayatri Jayatilakar at their media center, who got a PhD from the Open University and has been a great researcher too in online learning and managing their media operations there.
Mm. Charlotte, it's been a privilege talking with you. I've learned so much and really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thank you. Really appreciate the honor. Bye-bye.
You can learn more about Lani and her work from our website.
That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.